Chicago. This is the Logic Consortium, your bi-monthly dose of politics and policy here at 88.7 WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, broadcasting live from the campus Loyola University. And today we have a very special show. We have Professor Dr. Kate Floros in the studio.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, how are you?
Great.
And thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you. And today, one of your areas of focus is ethnicity and conflict.
That's right.
So, first of all, tell us what that is, how that is an area of focus of yours and an area of interest.
Okay, well, so we look around the world today and we see that in places like Syria, in the Middle East in general, places in Africa, we hear all kinds of people talking about how you have all these differences among the people who live there. So you have the Sunni-Shia split in Islam, you have Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda. And so what I look at in my research is how the size of these different groups in society in relation to each other and control of the government affects whether or not states might be liable to having a civil war or civil conflict, and in what circumstances that they wouldn't. And so that's basically how the two go together in my research. Does this differentiation of people into different groups and how political power is shared, does that affect, and how does that affect the likelihood of violence breaking out in that society?
So, first of all, kind of stepping back, obviously this is one of the areas of your study because you are a professor of political science.
That's right.
And kind of before we talk about how the size of an ethnicity or how they're being treated affects conflict, can we kind of step back and define ethnicity?
Absolutely. I mean, this is actually quite a contentious topic, just the definition of ethnicity itself. Typically, people acknowledge ethnicity to be some kind of subjective grouping of people based on a bunch of characteristics. They can be religious, racial, shared history, shared language. But really, to be part of an ethnic group, you have to think that you're part of that ethnic group. And so there's no real definition, or there's no real objective, this person is in this group versus not. You have to want to be part of the group and be accepted as part of the group to be in that group. And so it becomes a little bit difficult to talk about. So an example might be, in the United States, people come from all over the world. But we tend not to talk about, English Americans, and, only on special days do we talk about Irish Americans or Italian Americans or, Kenyan Americans or whatever. We tend to break that down into you have your white Europeans, your African Americans, Asians, Hispanic Americans, etc. And if you look inside each of those groups, there's a huge amount of diversity within that. So in another country, those differences within the group could be what's important in that country. Whereas in our country, what European country your ancestors came from among the white community in the United States, that doesn't matter as much anymore as maybe it did at the turn of the century when Italians and Irish were discriminated against, et cetera. And so ethnicity has different meanings in different countries based on whether or not ethnicity is what I call politicized or not. So being being Irish may be, something that people cheer at in a crowd during an election, but you're not going to, an Italian is not going to not vote for an Irish person in the United States because that person is Irish, right? Because the difference between being Irish American and Italian American is not a politicized difference. But there, the groups like African Americans or Hispanic Americans, those groups are politicized because there is a history of discrimination, maybe a language difference, et cetera. And so the difference between, even though African Americans have a variety of backgrounds, Hispanic Americans come from a variety of different countries, they tend to be grouped together in our politics. And so that identity, that grouping, becomes important.
So when looking at ethnicity and conflict and kind of how they play in together, I mean, it does seem that most of the, a lot of the wars that we see out there, or internal wars, civil wars, or external wars, do have to do with ethnicity. So, I mean, is it... a rivalry of ethnicities, or how does ethnicity play into conflict?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because there's a narrative that we frequently hear that's called ancient hatreds, right? These people have hated each other for centuries, and of course they're going to continue to fight. And, you know, as I said, this is all about perception of what group you belong to or not. And so this idea that, oh, these groups have hated each other forever, I don't find that very compelling, because there are long periods of time when groups coexist perfectly fine, and then times when violence erupts between them. And so if you're trying to say, well, they've always hated each other, then you have to explain why only sometimes they fight and sometimes they don't. So what I argue is that it comes with this politicization, hard word to say, of the ethnic status. And in a lot of these countries, there is a scarcity of resources. And I don't just mean a scarcity of water or oil or anything like that, but a scarcity of public jobs or public spending on infrastructure or other things. And so if you have a small pot of money that and jobs and other patronage that needs to be spent on your country, but it's a small amount, how do you determine who gets what? And in a lot of places, that decision is made by whoever is in power makes sure that their group gets the resources, or at least most of the resources, and then an even smaller amount has to be shared by the rest of the population. And so if you're in the in-group, you're probably taken care of pretty well. If you're not in the in-group, then you experience discrimination, economic hardship, etc. And so, of course, you want your guy to be in charge, because then maybe that small pot of resources will get shared with your group rather than this other one. And we see this, Kenya is an example of this, that hasn't broken out into full-scale war, thank goodness, but after the elections in 2006 or 2007, which people thought was a stolen election, it largely broke down on ethnic terms, because one group had been in power for a really long time, and a lot of the patronage of government went to that ethnic group, and other groups had been excluded. They thought their candidate had won, and so there were riots and a lot of ethnic violence. It wasn't because the two groups couldn't coexist peacefully. It was because group identity determined the distribution of resources in their country. And when they thought that, when the one group thought that they were going to capture the state, is another way we say it, and reap the benefits, and that election they felt was stolen from them, it caused this anger, because they knew they were going to continue to be in this situation of receiving less in comparison to the group that had been in power for a long time.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to the Logic Consortium here on 88.7 WLUW Chicago Sound Alliance. And today we're speaking with Dr. Kate Floros, professor of political science at the University of Illinois Chicago. And we're talking right now about ethnicity and conflict, one of her areas of study. So, Dr. Floros, what you're saying is it's not the conflict isn't so much caused by this ancient hatred or this theory that some have out there that there's an ancient hatred between ethnicities. You're saying it's not so much caused by that, the conflict, but rather certain groups grabbing hold of the resources of the state and leaving others out of the goodies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of it. I mean, think about it in your own family, right? If you have, you know, just enough to feed a few people, are you going to feed your family first, or are you going to go out and give that food to strangers? And, you know, so take this up onto a societal scale. And this is kind of the idea. And we can see this, an example of this is in Rwanda. There is not really any difference between the Hutus and the Tutsis. And folks who remember back into the 90s will remember the horrific genocide that occurred in Rwanda in 1994, where a group of Hutus tried to eradicate the Tutsis from Rwanda and ended up killing upwards of 800,000 to a million people. But the difference between the Hutu and Tutsis is largely made up. The Tutsis came from the herding class, and the Hutus were the agriculturalists, the pastoralists. So basically it was an economic distinction between the people who owned the cattle and were tended to be a little wealthier and the farmers. But when the Belgians came in during colonization, they took this basically economic class, because everybody spoke the same language, they were all Roman Catholic, they had this history, and they made them into these two different groups. They took the Tutsis, who were the smaller group, and they elevated them to positions of power in the colonial government. And when the Belgians left, they left the Tutsis in charge, and they were only about 15% of the population. So the 85% of the population, or just about, were kind of left out of the power structure. And so there was an overthrow and a couple civil wars until you finally get this situation where, you know, there was a group within the Hutu leadership who thought, we just need to get rid of this group who has no right to lead us because they're the minority. But if you go back generations, the difference between these two groups is almost nothing. It was a created difference by the colonial power taking this economic class and being the minority, setting them over the majority as an easier way for the Belgians to rule. And once Rwanda gets independence, it creates problems that exist to this day. But in that instance, if you go back and look, there is really not that much difference at all between these two groups, other than occupation, which I think most people would argue is not a basis of dividing people into ethnicities.
So those seem to be artificial differences in ethnicities, but there are, as you mentioned, not so artificial differences that have caused conflict. For example, in the Muslim world, the Sunnis and the Shia. And then outside in the Middle East, Jews and Arab Palestinians. So a lot of people who don't think a lot about this might say, oh, they're always going to fight, the Sunnis and the Shias, or the Jews in the Middle East and the Palestinians. So what do you think about those that say, or what do you have to say as a counter-argument or whatever to those that say, it is, they're always going to fight, and I don't think there's much we can do about that?
Well, again, I would say it has to do with the distribution of power among groups in those areas. So, you know, there have been Jews in the Middle East as long as there have been Jews, right? There have been Arabs in the Middle East as long as there have been Arabs. And absolutely over time, there have been periods where violence has flared between the groups. But most people would argue, I think, that the current animosity between Jews and Palestinians in Israel slash Palestine is over who controls the land, right? So when Israel was created by the UN in 1947, you know, basically what they said was, we're drawing a line on a map and we're giving this land to this group of people, and whoever is currently living there will just be under the jurisdiction of the Jews to whom we're giving Israel. And the people who lived there had no say in the matter. So a lot of them fled. And those are the folks who are still living, and their descendants who are still living in refugee camps in Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, folks who live in the West Bank, Gaza. And so it's not anything inherent about Judaism and Islam not being able to live side by side. And in fact, there are, you know, not a huge number, but there are Palestinians who are Christians, who are agnostic or atheist or whatever. I would argue that it's not religion. It's the fact that this land was taken by the international community, given to a group of people who wanted to create a Jewish state. So all the rules are, you know, consistent with Jewish principles, which in a lot of ways are consistent with Islamic principles as well. But it's saying, like, we don't care that you've been living here. We're giving this land to somebody else. And so all the fighting is about who controls the land, who has a right to live where. The control of Jerusalem is partially about religion, because it's holy to all three major religions. But it's not about, it's more about who has control of the area, not about the religious issues. So I would say it all comes down to politics. Right, Northern Ireland, Catholic versus Protestant. Right, that wasn't about, you know, whether the Pope should be head of the church or not. Right, Northern Ireland was about these English invaders came, took over the land, the South got free, got its independence, the North didn't. The people who lived there, the Irish, wanted to be part of the South. The British who had come over centuries earlier didn't. And so it's a fight about who controls the government of that area. It's not about whether the Pope should be head of the church or not. And so, again, if these differences are made political, that's when they really matter. But by themselves, these differences don't really mean anything. I mean, you put a Palestinian and an Israeli, Jewish-Israeli baby or toddlers into a room, and they'll play with each other. They don't know the difference, right? And so, you know, once you teach them, oh, they're your enemy for this reason, you know, that's when it becomes a problem.
Well, what do you mean by made political, for one? And the second thing, what about the Sunni-Shia split?
Okay. So made political, I mean, so think about Northern Ireland. Irish in the United States don't distinguish whether they're Irish or Protestant. Whether they're Catholic or Protestant, right? They're Irish, and they're happy to be Irish whether they're Protestant Irish or Catholic Irish, right? It doesn't matter, because that difference is not salient here. But it's salient there because there were laws that said that, they put quotas on who could get into what schools. So there were Catholic schools and Protestant schools. And just like in the United States in the days of segregation, you know, in Northern Ireland, the Protestant schools tended to be better than the Catholic schools. The Protestant areas of town were more affluent. The people got better jobs. And the Catholics, you know, had a harder time getting into certain jobs and tended to be of a lower socioeconomic status. And it was based just on whether you were Catholic or Protestant, not, you know, how good you were, nothing that had to do with meritocracy. So that's what I mean by politicized, right? You're treated how you're treated by law based on these ascriptive differences that you could use to separate people into groups, but you don't have to. Okay, so that's the politicization. The Sunni Shia, you know, I don't know enough about the history of Islam to speak too authoritatively, but that is a little bit different in the sense that it's to my understanding, it's a question of who is following the will of the Prophet and the will of God correctly. One could argue that this was also political back in the day when the split occurred about who was going to take over the movement. So, you know, the Prophet had died. One of his companions became the leader. He died, another companion. And then it became a question of, well, should it be his grandson, the Prophet's grandson, who takes over the movement, or some other companion? And one group supported the grandson, another group supported the companion, and there was a battle in which the grandson was killed, and the supporters of the grandson became the Shia, and the supporters of the companion, who decided that won that battle, became the Sunnis. Now, over time, differences in practice have grown up between the two sects. And, you know, I can't really speak to those differences. I'm not an Islamic scholar. But if you go back to that battle, it was about who leads this new religion. And at the time, Islam, unlike Judaism and Christianity, began, you know, with its back against the wall to the extent that, you know, they were under attack immediately. And so people say, oh, Islam is a warlike culture. Well, when they were started, they were attacked, and so they fought back and quickly were able to take over large swaths of the Middle East. And it turns out that this winning side, the Sunni side, was able to then spread Islam, etc. And so that's why there tend to be more Sunnis than there are Shia. But it kind of comes down to that split at the beginning of who should be the leader of this movement. And again, differences have occurred in the long history since that split happened, that may have more to do with the current conflict. But again, that doesn't really have to do with, you know, they were all Arabs at the time. But it was a political fight that has now led to this religious difference over time.
So, and let me remind everybody, this is the Logic Consortium here on 88.7 WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, and we're speaking with University of Illinois Professor Dr. Kate Floros, talking about ethnicity and conflict this half of the hour, and then on the other half, we're going to kind of delve into U.S. military policy. But to kind of start finishing off this half hour, Dr. Floros, so how do we avoid conflict between ethnicities? Is it just a matter of making sure everybody's treated equally? Is that the takeaway that we're getting here?
In a nutshell, yes. I mean, and obviously that's much harder said than done. I mean, in our own country, we have a problem with this, right? We have a history of discrimination of some groups, and we're having a hard time coming to terms with that ourselves. So, you know, there's no magic wand that you can then say, oh, yes, that now everything's going to be perfect. But I think we need to understand, instead of taking this shortcut of, oh, well, these two groups, they've hated each other forever. We can't let ourselves fall into that. We have to look at the political realities on the ground. We need to look at things like, you know, in Iraq, when Saddam Hussein was ruling Iraq, he was Sunni. But the Sunnis were a minority in Iraq. So you had a minority government. And so when Hussein was overthrown, you get the majority of the people are Shia. And if you have a democracy and we think that majority rules with minority protection, you're going to get Shia rule. Well, if you don't understand, which I don't believe the U.S. government did, really understood that this split and the historical problems with it, you know, didn't realize the can of worms that was being opened when this happened, you know, but they're the majority population. And so you would think that they would have a majority of the seats in Congress or in the parliament and probably the prime minister and all that, and all that. So then that what I said about the protection of minorities becomes very important. So you may have a group that is 85% of the population, but if they are consistently oppressing or leaving out of public jobs or public services the rest of their population, they're creating their own problems. And a lot of this comes down to how big is the pie that there is to disperse, right? Is the economy in these places such that everybody has a chance for a job because there are lots of jobs? In some of these places in the Middle East, for example, especially oil-rich places, you have a lot of the benefits of the oil industry maybe accruing to a certain group over another. If that's going to continue to happen, the people who are left out of that picture are going to be aggrieved. And especially if the excluded population is the majority of the population, you're going to have a lot of people who are aggrieved. And so the likelihood of conflict is just going to escalate the larger and larger the proportion of people who are left out of the economy is. And so using ethnicity as a shortcut for determining who gets resources or who gets opportunity and who doesn't, kind of sets the stage for competition and disgruntlement, et cetera. If you have a meritocracy, right, where if you're smart and you can pass the entrance exam to college, you get in, not we have a quota of only so many of your group can get in, right, then that helps to ease that problem. And so you need public policy that encourages the breaking down of distribution of benefits by ethnic group and increasing opportunities for all members of a society.
That definitely sounds like an area that our country and many countries could use improvement on. Let me open it up for calls right now on ethnicity and conflict. 773-508-9589. 773-508-WLUW. And, of course, you're listening to the Logic Consortium here on 88.7 Chicago Sound Alliance, WLUW. And we have Dr. Kate Floros, professor of political science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. It looks like we do have a call. Hold on. Let's see. Hello, you there, caller?
Yes, I am.
You're live on air.
Oh, great. I had a question for the guest.
Please go ahead.
Yeah. I was wondering, do you think religion is a bigger cause of war and conflict than ethnicity?
Well, some people lump religious differences into ethnic differences. And so when they talk about ethnicity, they talk about it in a broader sense of not just, you know, what people look like, but also religion as well. Language is also tends to be thrown in there as well. But I think religion is another way in which, groups can be distinguished from each other. And, you know, the Crusades, you know, back in the Middle Ages, that was definitely about, who should control the Holy Land. And that seemed to be, I mean, it was obviously political about who should control the land, but it did definitely hinge on, the religious ideas of what set of believers was legitimate. And we do see some of that. That was a motivation, that is a motivation of Al-Qaeda today, that, you know, Osama bin Laden said many times that one of his main goals is to get, you know, unbelievers out of the Holy Land, i.e. Saudi Arabia, where the two holiest cities in Islam, Mecca and Medina, are, because there shouldn't be these foreign infidels in the Holy Land. So I think there definitely are examples of conflicts that have been about purifying the land, and only the righteous or the right people should be in a particular region. But I would say that would be a vast minority, of cases. I think that even most religious, conflicts that we term religious conflicts are more about this distribution of resources than they are about the tenets of the religion itself.
Caller, thank you so much for the call. We'll be accepting calls in the second half of the hour, too, about U.S. military policy. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
So we're going to take a short break here, and you're listening to 88.7 WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, broadcasting live from the campus Loyola University, and this is the Logic Consortium with our guest, Dr. Kate Floros. We'll be right back with you.
Look around you. One in four kids in the U.S. faces hunger. It's not always easy to see the signs, but in this land of plenty, there are kids that don't know where they will get their next meal. Join Share Our Strength in Food Network and take the pledge to end childhood hunger here in America by 2015. Learn how at nokidhungry.org. Their next meal could come from you.
And we're back here on 88.7 WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, broadcasting live from downtown from the campus Loyola University. And this is the Logic Consortium, your bi-monthly dose of politics and policy. And today we're lucky enough to have Dr. Kate Floros in the studio, professor of political science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And thank you so much again for joining us today.
I'm having a good time. Thanks for having me.
Of course. It's a pleasure to have you. And we're going to kind of jump on, switching gears a little bit from ethnicity and conflict. I kind of wanted to just, as I talked to you about and as I mentioned, the United States military policy, military history. You know, we are today the world hegemon, obviously. And, I mean, our military is bigger than the next how many countries combined?
Well, I don't know about military personnel, but in terms of military spending, we make up over 40% of the global military spending.
And we have such a small percentage, or a third, about 4, 5, 6% of the population.
Right, about 5 or 6, yeah.
And then in the world, we're making up 40% of the military spending.
Right.
But this wasn't really always the case.
True.
That the U.S. outspent everybody else by huge numbers.
That's right.
So kind of bring us, can you trace it back and bring us up to this point, how we are spending this huge amounts of money nowadays versus the rest of the world and how it was different before?
Sure. When George Washington left office after his 2 terms as president, his farewell address, in it he said he encouraged his successors to avoid entangling alliances, and he meant especially with Europe. He wanted the United States to stay out of European affairs because that was only going to pull the United States into war and all kind of negative associations. And people tend to take this and the foreign policy that the U.S. had afterward as the U.S. being isolationist. And that's not really accurate, because the U.S. Was very concerned about trade and investment overseas and, you know, trading products and selling around the world. And so the U.S. was heavily involved with other countries in its economic policy. Also, if you think about the Monroe Doctrine, which was basically the United States said, Europe, get out of the Western Hemisphere. And the underlying point was we're going to take over. The U.S. is going to take over, you know, being the big dog in the Western Hemisphere. And it was like, you know, colonial powers, get out of the Western Hemisphere. But what that opened up the door for was then instead of Britain or France or Spain, running areas of South America and Latin America, the Caribbean, the U.S. kind of took over. And, you know, in the, from the founding of the country to World War One, there were, I don't know the exact number, but, you know, over 100 military interventions, U.S. military interventions around the world. So this idea that the U.S. wasn't involved militarily around the world is erroneous. However, it is absolutely true that it was not even remotely to the extent that it became after World War II. So U.S. becomes the most powerful, economically powerful country in the world somewhere around 1910-ish, but doesn't want to act like a world power. So it's perfectly happy to keep trading with other countries and getting richer and providing opportunity and all this stuff. Doesn't really want to play a huge role in world affairs. World War One comes around. This is a classic European power play, you know, who's going to control what territory, a declining empire trying to hold on to what it needs, you know, what it can in the face of changing times. And President Wilson tried to keep the U.S. out of the war as long as he could. He thought it really didn't have much to do with the U.S. Until finally, you know, German U-boat strategies were sinking all kinds of ships and killing American citizens. And so the U.S. reluctantly gets involved in World War One in 1917. Doesn't actually end up sending troops until 1918. And so all told, the U.S. is actively participating in World War One for about 6 months. But as soon as World War One's over, you know, Wilson tries to create, or does create, the League of Nations, so the U.S. never joins. But the U.S. kind of goes back across the Atlantic to try and be prosperous and all this stuff. When World War II rolls around, remember World War II starts in Europe in 1937. I'm sorry, 1939. We could argue that World War II actually started in 1937 when Japan invades China. But historians don't count that. So the U.S. doesn't get involved until the bombing of Pearl Harbor at the end of 1941. And so, again, here's this war going on in Europe. There's this war that we tend to forget about that's going on in Asia. And the U.S. is staying out of it. Now, granted, we have lend-lease programs. We've got all these things that are, you know, the U.S. is kind of involved, but it's technically neutral. Pearl Harbor happens, U.S. declares war on Japan, Germany declares war on the U.S. declares war on Germany, and now the U.S. is in. Well, this is the second war in, you know, whatever, 20 years, that the U.S. has had to send young men over to Europe, and in this case also to Asia, to fight against fascism, to fight against these, you know, terrible values, et cetera, et cetera. And then right on the heels of the victory in World War II, the U.S. decommissions its military rather quickly because it's ready to go back across the Atlantic. However, the Soviet Union tests a nuclear device. The Soviet Union goes back on its promises about holding free and fair elections in Eastern Europe. And everything now is seen through the prism of potential Soviet expansion. We just fought this war to end Nazism and Hitler's, you know, march all over Europe. Only, you know, as time goes on, we find out about the concentration camps and the horrible death toll. And now here we are, our former ally, and now we think, the U.S. thinks, here's another expansionary power, and we've got to do something to stop it. So rather than go back across the Atlantic and try and just be an economic power again, the U.S. realizes, okay, we need to stay engaged in Europe because if we don't, the Soviet Union's going to take over. We've got to be engaged around the world because the Soviets want expansion. They want to spread communism around the world. And if we're not vigilant, this is what's going to happen. And this is what starts to explain the military bases all over the world. Because the spread of communism, and then China becomes communist in 1949. And so now you've got Russia and China, even though those two countries actually had a very antagonistic relationship through most of the Cold War. And the U.S. felt it was, it and democracy was under attack. And so the philosophy of containment, of not letting communism spread from where it already was, necessitated in the minds of U.S. policymakers the need to have American troops around the world to prevent communism from expanding to other places. Now, the U.S. also got involved in other things as well, right? It started the World Bank, the IMF, the United Nations, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It created alliances with a bunch of other countries. It sent Marshall Plan money to Europe to help rebuild Europe, gave lots of economic aid to Japan. Things like the Peace Corps were created to try and, you know, have U.S. presence in countries, and hopefully keep communism from spreading. USAID and development programs. All of this was done, so that the economic conditions that had led to World War II wouldn't happen again. But then also to make the idea of not being communist attractive, so that communism wouldn't spread.
So, taking that a little bit further, I mean, obviously we engage in all these wars, well, at least Vietnam, to kind of try to prevent the spread of communism, well, the Korean War, way before Vietnam.
Yep.
But the Cold War ends.
It does.
In 1989, 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have these military bases mm-hmm. in all these different countries.
That's right.
So, I mean, if we justified it as, you know, to prevent the spread of communism and to protect democracy, Russia didn't follow through on its promise to have elections. So if that was the justification for these enormous amount, and I don't even know how many countries have U.S. military bases. I mean,
oh, a lot. There's U.S. military presence in, not necessarily bases, but, you know, almost every country in the world has military troops in some capacity. So it's very extensive.
So what is the continued justification? I mean, is it out? I don't know. Since, I mean, it has to maybe have changed since 1990. But 1990, end of the Cold War till now. I mean, is there a continued justification for this massive U.S. military presence?
Well, some people argue yes, others argue no. So, when the Cold War ended, and the date of the end of the Cold War is also up for debate, but when George Bush Elder, who I call Bush 41, being the 41st president, when Bush 41 was president, he talked about a new world order and how the end of the Soviet threat and, you know, Russia was on its way to democracy, right? They were trying to democratize and all this stuff. And so there would be this new world order and, you know, freedom would flourish and democracy would flourish. And it was this great utopian idea. And people were hoping to reap what is known as a peace dividend. And it's this idea that instead of putting all this money towards military, you can invest that same money into domestic programs or whatever it is. And so your economy would flourish because instead of diverting all this money to military, you know, you can invest in whatever you need to invest in to make your economy grow. But almost immediately, you get the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein, and you get this massive collective security operation that we know of as Operation Desert Storm. And this was really successful. And then you saw a bunch of, you know, what we think of as ethnic wars starting to break out all over the Third World. And we tend to forget that most of these countries were clients of either the U.S. or the Soviet Union. And when it was convenient, or when, you know, there were lots of what are known as proxy wars during the Cold War. So it was the U.S. was supporting one side in the war, Soviet Union was supporting another side in the war, and they would have these wars in these small countries around the world. I mean, you know, you name it. Places in Africa, et cetera. And it meant that the two big superpowers didn't have to fight each other. Okay, so you had all these, but they also, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, had people in place, the rulers, dictators, whoever, in place that kept a lid on problems in those countries. So once the sponsorship of the U.S. and the Soviet Union goes away, a lot of these dictators can, like, all their military aid goes away, and they can't keep a lid on these problems that we were talking about earlier. And so you start seeing a lot of these civil wars popping up in the post-Cold War period. So we just had this successful military operation in Iraq. Now we have these civil wars all over the world, and they get this idea of, well, let's do peacekeeping. So you start seeing peacekeeping operations all throughout the Third World, trying to help countries put themselves back together after wars. And while a lot of these troops aren't U.S. troops, the idea that the world is going to be this happy, harmonious place takes a hit. And, you know, as time marches on, there are people talking about, okay, well, we can start cutting military spending. And then 9/11. And then it all becomes about terrorism, Al-Qaeda, which is, I mean, justifiably, the U.S. was attacked, and the nature of the threat was very different than the U.S. had felt before, because this was a non-state actor. They were in multiple places. They were in small groups. They weren't easily identifiable, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, there was this kind of, it kind of replaced communism as the big threat. And so, you know, now U.S. efforts are pointed in that direction. Now, I would argue, one last point, I would argue that a lot of the reason that there is opposition to decreasing military spending is because our defense budget is largely a jobs program in the United States. If you think about all the companies that produce military weapons, hardware, where military bases are located in the United States, a lot of districts in the United States have a lot of military dollars in them. And if you cut back on military spending, you're cutting all those contracts, and so all the people who work in those munitions factories or working on whatever attack helicopter they're building or whatever, all those jobs go away too. And so a lot of people would argue that the defense budget is pretty much the only jobs plan that the United States has, and cutting the defense budget means laying off lots of people, and that's unpopular.
So, thinking about the peace dividend, that's more of like a at-war type of dividend that people are discussing.
Right. And that, I mean, that was what, when Eisenhower was president, he talked about beware of the military-industrial complex, that this is policymakers, defense contractors, you know, people in government who have an incentive to keep the military churning out products. And why would you turn out products if you weren't using it? And so the fear was that, you know, the U.S. would get into conflicts in order to keep this military industrial complex in business. That may be a little too cynical, even for me. I don't think that, you know, I don't think that, certainly not Afghanistan, and I don't even think Iraq had anything to do with, okay, we need to go to war somewhere so people can make money. Now, certainly people did make a lot of money off those wars, but I don't think that decisions about intervention are driven by this profit motivation. But I think many parts of the defense budget are. So, for example, I had a student in Missouri who was doing research on this very thing, the defense budget. And she was looking at one budget where the Pentagon asked for one certain kind of submarine, and the Congress wanted two. And so they compromised by funding 1.5 submarines. Okay, so Pentagon wanted one, Congress wanted two, now they're funding 1.5 submarines. What are you going to do with half a submarine? What is the point of funding half a submarine? I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, which half, right? It's going to get water in it somehow, right? But why do you do this? Because whoever was building those submarines, they got the money for, you know, and they started making half the submarine, and maybe next year we could get money for the other half or whatever. But this is kind of the calculus, right? That, you know, we have these companies in our districts, in our state, that make the components that go into this submarine. And if we don't build it, all those workers are going to be laid off. So
this idea of this military-industrial complex, that the private manufacturers of all the war equipment kind of lobby Congress to keep spending on that war equipment so they can keep churning out profits to the private industry. So you're saying that it's real in some sense because it does cause Congress to spend money, but it's not as prominent as some people say in causing decisions about intervention.
Right. I think it has more to do with military spending than military action. This military industrial complex is much more about spending than it is about actual putting soldiers in harm's way. And you notice the part of the military budget, Veterans Affairs is not in the defense budget. That's a separate part. That's part of the discretionary spending that is, we always talk about cutting. And, you know, soldiers' wages are not very good. Soldiers' benefits are not very good. So the money that goes in the defense budget, A, is not for our veterans, and B, very little of it actually goes to our servicemen and women themselves. It's a lot about the equipment, maintaining the bases, things like that.
That is very interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah.
So let me open it up for callers. We got about 7 minutes left here in the hour. It has gone by quickly. And 773-508-9589, 773-508-WLUW. We're here in the studio with Dr. Kate Floros, professor of political science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And we were just talking about the military-industrial complex. We're talking about U.S. military policy, military history, and kind of following up on the military-industrial complex, the drones now are kind of the flavor of the last 5-7 years or even more. President Obama has, they say, sent an unprecedented amount of drones around the world. He's really ratcheted up. I know there was that series of articles in the New York Times last year, I believe, that talked about his unprecedented control that he has over the kill list and the people on the drone list. So this idea of drones, because they say it could be so effective in that you don't have to send soldiers into harm's way and their pinpoint accuracy, but then also the in terms of the negative effects, there's a lot of quote-unquote collateral damage or whatever you want to call them. And I know the U.S. has some crazy numbering system that any person that's a male over the age of 20 who is killed is still considered an enemy combatant or something of that nature, or a person, an enemy of the United States. So, and then also, obviously, people that are killed, the argument goes, their entire family, it fuels some type of hatred against the United States. So what about this drone program that's going on now? Are we going to see more of it? In your eyes, has it been effective in some ways more than others?
Yeah, this is a tough one. And I think, you know, for another program with a different guest, you might want to ask about the use of drones in the United States, because that's an interesting and very tangled privacy issue for American citizens. But I'm not going to digress onto that topic. The idea, I believe, behind using drones is that drones can target potential belligerents in tough to reach areas. They can, you don't have to worry about loss of American life. And the fact that President Obama has absolutely used drones, in targeted attacks far more than the Bush administration did. Some people say, I mean, it's kind of a good thing though that the president himself approves or disapproves each attack, because then at least it's not, you know, as Harry Truman said, the buck stops here, right? I mean, so if the president makes a mistake, you know, we know who's responsible. At the same time, it seems pretty macabre. I can't imagine sitting in that meeting and deciding, oh yeah, let's kill that guy today. But you also see that it hasn't precluded the use of U.S. Special Forces. So, for example, the Bin Laden raid, there was actual talk, if you believe the Zero Dark Thirty movie, that of using a drone and just blowing up the compound. But they thought, no, we have to make sure that it's actually Bin Laden, et cetera. And so they sent in a Special Forces team. There were also, I'm not even sure how many months ago it was now, there were two Special Forces, operations, one in, Tripoli, Libya, and one in, Somalia. The Somalia one, didn't work. They didn't get their target, but all the Americans got out safely. And in Libya, they were able to snatch their target. And he ended up on a ship in the middle of an ocean somewhere, being interrogated. So, you know, it's not that the U.S. Special Forces aren't active, but you're not gonna send a drone strike into the middle of a city, right? Because that just the amount of collateral damage would be unacceptable. But if you think about, you know, a mountain pass in, you know, a faraway country, inserting and exfiltrating a Special Forces team is very, very difficult. And we see that Taliban, Al-Qaeda operatives tend to operate in these environments in Pakistan, Afghanistan, etc. And so in those cases, it might be the most effective way to go after targets without putting American troops in danger. The problem is, obviously, if you get it wrong and you end up killing a bunch of innocents, or even if you get it right and end up killing a bunch of innocents, what that policy is saying is that that is an acceptable level of, you know, collateral death that we're willing to accept in order to take out this target. I'm sure the families of those people don't agree with that. But it's not any different from, I mean, if you think about it, it's actually much more efficient and much less lethal than, you know, bombing raids during World War II, right? When they took out Dresden, right? You know, that led to, you know, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How many people died there, right? So you could have those kinds of missions, or you have these targeted attacks that do kill people other than Al-Qaeda or Taliban or whoever they're going after. And obviously for the families involved, the loss of life is horrible. But on a comparative scale, it's relatively minor. Now, your point about, you know, any male over the age of 15 and under 60 or under 70 is a legitimate target. You know, that's something that has kind of crept into not just our thinking about war, but, you know, if you look at Srebrenica in Bosnia, this was a supposedly safe haven of the UN, and it was coming under Bosnian Serb attack, and they decided that they were going to evacuate the women and children which left all of the men and boys, you know, over 15, under 70 or whatever the age was, in Srebrenica. And then that safe haven was overrun by Bosnian Serbs and everybody was massacred, over 8,000 men and boys. Now, you can't tell me that all 8,000 of those men and boys were belligerents, you know, in the Bosniak army. Probably almost none of them were. But because they were of military age, they didn't receive the same protections as the women and children. So I always tell my male students that they should be lucky that they're here and not somewhere else where just their age group puts them into this category of potential belligerent and makes them